My big fear is for this to work, it has to come to a resolution fairly quickly. Because my fear is if this is up in the air for more than, say, 4 to 6 weeks by the end of May, this could spiral completely out of control.
The forcing function is, we just did something to you that will annihilate your entire economy within 6 weeks.
This whole thing is an attempt to decouple from China.
China is going to destabilize and the story of China is over. That is my prediction.
Okay, so Hans and I, just like everybody else on planet Earth, are trying to figure out what the hell's going on. What is happening right now? So just a very quick we'll go down the events that have happened in the last 24 hours. So the tariffs are set to still go on for a majority of the entire world, really, on the 9th, I believe, or the 8th. One of these 2 days in the next couple of days here. And then we had China came back and said that on the day after they're going to hike their tariffs. And then today, for 3 seconds, it seemed like on the market, there was a story that leaked that said Trump was going to put a 90-day pause on tariffs for the rest of the world, except for China. And then 3 seconds later, the Trump administration said fake news. And then China came out, excuse me, and then Trump came out and said that if China doesn't remove the retaliatory tariffs, that he was going to hike the U.S. tariffs by another 50%. And the stock market went up and went down, and it went up and went down. And then the yields went up and down. The inflation, just, it's crazy. What is happening? Okay, and this is where, in this conversation, Hans and I are going to try to parse through everything we've absorbed for the last few days. I've tried to take in as much as possible from all different angles. I've listened to quite a few podcasts this morning. Hopefully they come out cogent in this discussion as far as like where my head is at. I'll kick off by saying that it does feel like Trump is playing with fire. This could go sideways very, very fast. I think the amount of pressure he's feeling from the business community and the market community is very difficult to ignore. He's clearly making a lot of people extremely uncomfortable. The people panicans. That were against him. Panicans, as he calls it. Which is a hilarious term, but I think it's, yeah, usually when somebody says don't panic, they're probably panicking. So maybe he might be a panican. But anyway, so and then the people that didn't believe in him from the very beginning, they are using this as a way of saying, see, I told you he's a lunatic. Now, my read is that this whole thing is an attempt to decouple from China. To try to reduce the reliance of the United States and a lot of the Western nations, but primarily the United States, because Trump has direct ability to influence U.S. policy and their economic alignment, obviously. I think this is a forceful way to decouple their reliance of the U.S. and China, since COVID highlighted a lot of the weaknesses. And a lot of this insaneness with the tariffs, even though the administration has come forward and said, hey, this is one way for us to generate revenue for the country and we're going to go a whole new different way, I really think the piece that's being discussed is that they are also trying to use this, the Trump administration, to gather bids and to gather leverage against China from countries that would give the U.S. a beneficial trade agreement where companies are then... they have a forcing function or an incentive to move away from China and start doing business potentially from those countries, or even the United States, with sweetened deals with taxes, et cetera, et cetera. I think a lot of the rhetoric from the administration is pointing towards this specific thing happening. China is also the one that came out with very forceful retaliatory tariffs. And while everybody else kind of just sat tight, including Europe, Israel, I mean, basically every other U.S. ally, except actually the EU just came out, sorry, about 5-10 minutes ago, this is how fast moving this whole thing is. They were going to put in additional tariffs of 25% across the board on the United States, but starting on May 18th or May 19th. So there is a significant sort of 1 month and 1 week window from when the U.S. tariffs were going to affect. My assumption is that the reason why they did that is to try and say, hey, don't screw us over, but we're here to negotiate. Let's make something happen. Over the weekend, you had a lot of countries come forward saying, think of Vietnam, You had Taiwan, you had other countries come forward and say, hey, we'll go from 0 to 0. Even the EU folks said, hey, we go to 0 to 0. If you take your tariffs down to 0, we'll go down to 0. We'll go true free trade, so on and so forth. So there's clearly a lot of movement. But the big concern here is that all of this movement, moving around, it's happening too fast, it's too brute force, and it's going to create too much of a uncertain nature to the markets and the business community as a whole, where the ability for the broader economy to adjust to this new reality is too big of a shock, and it could cause a lot of unintended consequences. So I'll shut up there for as long as I can. And then, Hans, I don't know, like what, and here's the other thing too, right? Like, we can bring on anybody. We could bring on freaking Trump himself. We could bring on Elon. We could bring on whoever. We could bring on Xi. I don't think anyone knows what the hell is going on. That's the key thing here. Nobody, I don't even think Trump knows what's going on. I think Trump is like, okay, this is where we have to go. We'll figure it out on the way. I think that's how he operates. And he's using, like, his latest game is using America as his bargaining chip. And people are like, you are fucking crazy. And I think a lot of that is warranted. Like, I think most of that is warranted because nobody else has done something like this before. So anyway, what do you think is going on?
Yeah, it has been absolutely insane. But I think I come back to just the idea that Trump, first and foremost, loves to make deals. Like, there's nothing that this man loves more than making deals. And he wants to make the biggest deals that have ever been made. And
the best.
So this is, you know, it feels very, very chaotic, I think, from the outside looking in. But on the other hand, I feel like a lot of this is somewhat predictable in retrospect. And, you know, you hit on it when you talked about COVID, that I think a lot of the world has woken up to just how unhealthy the relationship that we all have with China can be, because China views their interactions with everyone else as a very intense power game that's based on leverage. And because they view everyone else that way, and much of the rest of the world has been naive to that, like, we got ourselves into somewhat of hot water. And this is specifically the CCP. I think the Chinese people are one of the most amazing, industrious, high character, like, group of people.
Hardworking, unbelievable.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, like, they have an incredible people. And I think the Chinese people themselves are some of the first and worst victims of the CCP specifically. And so this is, you know, not a knock against the Chinese people at all. This is commentary on the Chinese Communist Party itself, that, you know, the party is totalitarian. They are very, very much, because they are a totalitarian regime, their survival is very, very, very dependent on managing power dynamics. They have to manage power dynamics within the country, and they have to manage power dynamics outside of the country. And it's just the lens through which they view the entire world. And that has led to us arriving the place where we are, where we have, you know, two great powers, essentially. There is the United States. Hi, Joe. So, welcome.
Hans.
It's great to have you here.
Nice to meet you. Very last second. I really appreciate you making it. What time zone are you in, by the way? I don't even know what time zone you're in.
I'm far, far away right now. I'm in Europe, Helsinki time zone.
Oh, shit. Oops. Wow. So I woke you up.
No, it's like random. It's 9:18 p.m. It's the magic of the internet. The evening. It's just spontaneous.
Wonderful. Yeah. Great. Great to meet you. Yeah. We're actually, thank you for making the time. Hans is going through his sort of where he thinks this whole tariff thing's going on. We'll throw you the mic once Hans finishes his thought here, and then keep going if that's okay with you.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, to continue this power dynamic between the United States and China, you know, China is a rising global power. I think Ray Dalio does a great job of explaining a lot of these dynamics in the Changing World Order and how countries go broke. And he's just laying out the fact that where we are today is a very intense competition that, you know, a lot of people don't understand that in the wake of the nuclear bomb, that warfare really changed dramatically. And we live now in an era of hybrid warfare, and China has been engaged in hybrid warfare with the rest of the world. And really, hybrid warfare is just the name of the game. This is how Cold War 2.0, or the Cold War, played out. And now it is how Cold War 2.0 is also playing out. That, you know, competition between the United States and Russia throughout the last half of the century, last century, was never direct conflict. It's always these indirect conflicts, and other countries kind of get caught in the middle. And especially now, in the 21st century, trade is one of the major areas where that economic warfare plays out. And China has made very strategic moves to try to, both through fair competition and then anti-competitive tactics, soak up a lot of these very strategically important areas of the economy when it comes to raw material supply chains, when it comes to technologies like artificial intelligence and battery technology and drones, and the whole host of other strategically important technologies. I mean, this is why there's bioweapons research going on in Wuhan and all these things. And so in this type of a hybrid war scenario, we have to reconsider, okay, the relationship that we have with China and their use of leverage against us, is that something that we want to allow to just persist as the status quo, or does it need to be changed? And Trump has been very forceful since his, you know, first term, that we really need to reevaluate this relationship with China very strongly, and we need to be very serious and have our eyes open and our guard up about what the future looks like in our relationship with China. And so I 100% agree with you, Farzad, that all of this entire negotiation is entirely about the United States and China trying to reorder trade relationships around the globe to recognize this fact. And I think the only thing that I would add to, you had a great post earlier on X that was kind of laying out your thoughts on why this is all about the United States versus China. And of course, you know, the administration has talked a lot about wanting to bring back manufacturing here to the United States. And I think that that's true around a specific set of industries, and maybe some assembly and some supply chain security. I don't think that that's necessarily true across the board. I think that we would actually prefer to be able to outsource a lot of our industry to other nations. We just want it to be those supply chains and those industries to be secure from this reliance on China specifically. And so while I do 100% expect them to bring some industries, some businesses, some supply chains domestically back to the United States specifically, I think that they're also, as soon as they get the ones that they care about secure, they're going to declare a win on those specific things. And then the countries or partners that we can find who will actually help us get to our strategic objective of independence from China in the areas that we care about, those people will actually have the opportunity then to absorb some of the manufacturing that we're going to be moving away from China. And we can still have more of a free trade relationship with them where they actually get to industrialize as well, develop a lot of the industry that is important, but that we don't want here. We just don't want it to be in China.
Yeah, that's, I really appreciate that. And let me bring in Joe then. So Joe, for those that are not familiar, he has a YouTube channel, Joe Bakhti on YouTube, and it's fantastic. He does a ton of analysis. He covers the Tesla story closely, which I know a lot of you do as well, but he's been doing a great series of videos on the Trump tariffs and a bunch of different things that are going on here. And your video from this morning, Joe, was very eye-opening because the way you laid out the thesis and sort of all the imbalances and everything was great. So a quick introduction for the audience, for those that might not be familiar with you, and then we'll give you the mic for go for as long as you want. Like, what the fuck's happening? What's happening? Can you tell us what's happening?
That's a very good question that a lot of people are asking right now. So first, thanks for having me on. It's the first time on Farzad, and great to meet you both. I watch you a lot, so it's great to be here. My background is just I'm an economist, I was in quantitative finance. I was also in a biotech very recently, the last 10 years, entrepreneur in LA and Berkeley. Now taking a little time off and focusing on YouTube, because I learned during my time as an entrepreneur, like in the end, you need to have people you're interacting with, an audience. I think that is the future of entrepreneurship. I think that's also what Elon does so brilliantly, that he actually communicates. He's actually a master communicator, even though he's a little awkward. Maybe that's his trick, his hack. But I think that's one of the great strengths that people, why people have so much loyalty to Elon and Tesla, because we understand what we are doing there. It's not just the car, it's the whole, I don't have to tell you guys, but it's a very big thing and it's very important to talk to people. So that's why I decided to also have a YouTube channel. My focus is the age of AGI. That's actually the meta theme, that we are going through an insane transformation. Tesla just randomly happens to be the eye of the storm. So I'm not doing it because of Tesla, it's just the other way around. I believe we go through an enormous transformation right now, where the tariffs are just a micro stress test. COVID was just a micro stress test that revealed a lot of problems, including leadership problems, you know, in the Biden administration in the US, but also in the European Union. And now much better leadership with, I think, with Trump and Elon and JD Vance. That's why it's so exciting for me to look at tariffs, to look at politics, to look at what's going on in Europe, in Germany, the AfD. Why does Elon get so involved? What's behind that? And now the whole tariff situation. So I think, you know, in this time to make good predictions, in this super disruptive time, it's important to connect these dots. Technology, artificial intelligence, AGI transformation. People like Elon Musk and their transformative impact on everything. Tesla as a company, but then also Trump, the tariffs, macro politics, what's the role of China? Hans said some brilliant things there. So connecting these dots around that core narrative, the total disruption of our economy, society, and our lives with artificial intelligence requires a lot of intelligence, no pun intended. So we need to put our heads together as YouTubers. I think the YouTubers did an amazing job. Farzad, you built this amazing channel, and Hans puts a lot of intelligence also into that. The other guys, Herbert, but even beyond that on X, I think it's more than just a hobby. Also, investing is more than a hobby. I think it's the only job left very soon. You need to be smart about your capital. For that, you need to be smart about the world, everything that's happening. And macro plays an increasingly important role for everyone. And so, yeah, super exciting. So when these tariffs happened, I saw all these reporting problems, right? How CNBC reports on it. All these analysts saying dumb stuff, including our friend Dan Ives. I don't know what's happening to him. You guys.
Shout out my fellow Penn Stater. We went to the same school.
Nice. Well, you learned more than Dan, it seems, but I don't want to bash Dan too much. He's a great guy, but I mean, what he posted there is not great. So when that happened, and I commented on my video today on Bloomberg, right? It's this big fake news problem that Trump brought up with the media that Elon now experiences and that we now experience. When we talk about China and these tariffs and what Trump is doing, everything now boils down to the question, is Trump crazy? Does he not know what he's doing? Is he going to crash the economy? Is this a recession? Is the whole administration unhinged? Or is it some form of 4D or 3D or 2D chess that we better understand quickly? And what Hans said is very smart. Like it boils down to this question, what is this actually all about? I totally agree. In my video today, this is about China and the United States. Everything else is just a little bit side, you know, are side battles. And what I outlined is, why are these side battles, this global battle for tariffs, so important? Because if you don't fight them, if you don't put a 25% tariff on the penguins, right, on the, whatever, I always forget these islands, like these islands with only penguins, that's not a mistake. Because if you don't put tariffs on the penguins, next thing you know is these penguins export like, you know, $50 billion of cars into the United States for some reason. The reason being that China tells the penguins, here is $50 billion worth of cars. Can you ship them to the United States? Because you have 0% tariffs because you're penguins. So I think it's about closing all these loopholes. And I outlined it with Vietnam as an example. Vietnam, you know, exports $130 billion to the United States, but imports from China $85 billion. So it's a pass-through situation. Maybe they touch it quickly and assemble like two pieces. But that's why you can't just focus on China. That's why China, not just, you know, China, Chinese exports are not just $400 billion to the United States. It's close to $1 trillion indirectly exporting it. And by tightening all these loopholes and closing them, which is very complicated, because how do you even do that? I don't know the answer, what's happening in these negotiations, but that includes everything from forcing Vietnam to put tariffs on Chinese imports into Vietnam, for example. So these are very complex negotiations. By doing that, China gets in the into the defensive. Back to Bloomberg, why all of you guys who are watching us and other people, you have to be very cautious where you get your information from. Because when I tuned into Bloomberg, I tuned in this morning, I was still in bed. That's how I wake up in the morning, take out my iPad at 6 a.m. and check out what's going on. And then Bloomberg was on in China or something. They said the dumbest stuff. And when smart people on TV say dumb stuff, it rings an alarm bell. It's like, well,
what's an example of a dumb thing they said?
They had the super savvy Chinese investment manager. And she said, and Bloomberg asked, like, well, Trump is doing these things, but now we retaliate, or China is retaliating. How is this going to end? And then she said, well, China has prepared for this for a long time. China can take this very long, like 4 years, no problem. And they know Trump is under a tremendous pressure. The markets will crash. So China has already prepared the next move, that Trump will bail and cave because the US cannot sustain this. And I was like, wait a moment. Who's exporting what to whom? Isn't like China relying on $1 trillion of US consumption? And the US is like nearly nothing from China? And if they both shut the trade down, how long can China survive? And I did some like macro math, like I think like 8 weeks. And then, you know, someone puts Xi's head on a stick in Beijing and that's it. And that's game over. So that was clearly wrong. I also asked Rock, you know, about what are the typical margins of these exporting Chinese companies? And you're talking 1 to 10% margin. Okay, what happens if you have 1 to 10% margin and someone puts 34% tariffs on you? Like you're dead. You're immediately dead. You know, you're also not competitive. You cannot just increase the price. That's the whole point, that you don't sell anything. So these tariffs are pretty deadly if they are combined, not just on China, but on the rest, which they are. So I think the predicament China is in is vastly greater than people even understand. China cannot, in my opinion, 54% tariffs, which it is right now, 34% on top of the 20 that they had, the fentanyl tariffs. They cannot survive that for long. Like 8 weeks, that's what I give them. Then they have a major implosion going on, like with huge ripple effects. And so I think that's the truth. And I think Trump understands that. And I outlined that if you go into some kind of tariff war out of the deal, ideally you make sure you have won that war before you even start it. And how do you win this? Well, the United States is just has the vastly longer leverage on this whole thing. So I think that's why Trump is so determined, because he knows China cannot survive that for long. And my prediction is that the fentanyl piece of the tariffs, which is 20% of the 54%, China is going to cave on that first, because that's an easy, kind of an easy yep. thing, right? They just have to stop subsidizing fentanyl exports and precursors. Of course, you know, when you talk about macro situations and politics, everything is much more complex. I tell you one fun story that I just learned recently, the details. And then I will explain how this relates probably directly to the fentanyl problem in China. Because you would ask, why is Xi not stopping, you know, the subsidies for fentanyl precursors that are then exported illegally into the United States? And why is China, the Chinese Communist Party, why do they support actively subsidize not just the precursors for fentanyl, but also some of the exporting companies that export that stuff to Mexico to kill Americans? Like, why? And there's this super fun story that I learned, or not fun, it's very sad, about Zelensky and the meltdown in the White House. I don't know if you guys heard about this, like the mineral deal and what actually happened behind the scenes. Did you hear about that?
I've heard rumors, but I'm curious to hear your take. So you tell me all this is connected.
So I think Besant or Lutnick, one of them, told the story that when I think Besant went to
I think it was Kiev, Besant, yeah.
And he went to Kiev and he said they already agreed on signing that mineral deal. And they had it all outlined, right, on the lunch desk in the White House. And then when Zelensky came, he knew about nothing. He's like, oh, whatever, I can't sign this. And turns out that people like Zelensky, or also Xi, by the way, also Putin, they are not dictators, as everyone says. They are sitting there and they are dependent on a lot of other people that have a lot of power in their countries. So they are not the lone decision maker. And the problem is in all of these three countries, there is enormous amounts of corruption going on. And these mineral deals, you know, they introduced also transparency, right? They create all these joint ventures with US audits and everything. And if you're in a kleptocracy like Ukraine, where all your buddies, you know, steal billions of dollars from the aid and the government, the last thing you want is the US auditing your shit, right? And there's like, what the hell? What is this guy looking at my bank account? Like, this is not a small thing. This is about survival, right? If you deal with a Ukrainian mob, they tell you, dude, if you sign this, good luck waking up alive tomorrow. And so Zelensky.
And not just you,
like,
but your entire family.
And your entire family and whoever. So Zelensky was freaking out, right? He said, damn, I promised to sign this thing, but I'm not going to sign this. I have a family. And I think China is just a whole ball game bigger. But what we have to expect is, why is Xi sitting there not ending these ridiculous subsidies for killing Americans, right? These fentanyl stuff. And I think people underestimate the vastness of that industry. These are tens of billions of dollars we are talking about. And there are Mexican cartels involved. There's money laundering involved, huge multi-billion dollar money laundering from, you know, things where China builds certain things, then it basically pays through the fentanyl, the Mexican cartels, and then they funnel the money to the cartels and indirectly get paid so China can avoid the capital export restrictions. It's like all crazy stuff. So basically they're paying with fentanyl. But on top of that, who are they paying? Some very important Chinese people. And I think if it would be up to Xi, Xi would just say, end this stuff and give me my 20% tariffs back. I think there is something going on. He probably can't. Or at least there's major hurdles behind the scenes. And so these are all, you know, that's why I always have to laugh when people on X or somewhere say, oh, Trump is dumb. He's like, he's so dumb. He doesn't understand that, you know, whatever, like we need these rare earth minerals. Like, this is like 100D chess, and Trump probably understands half of it, 50D, and these guys on wherever understand like 0D. So, and I don't understand all. I mean, of course, Trump knows way more than me. And so we have to always connect the dots intelligently and use our brain intelligently, but we have to know the known unknowns or the unknown unknowns. Like, there's a lot of stuff there that's very complicated. It's not just China and the US. It's Xi, it's Trump, it's tons of corrupt Chinese executives. It's complicated stuff. So we need to, the reason why I'm bullish on this is because when I look at Besant and Lutnick and Trump and Elon and David Sachs and everyone, there are very intelligent people managing this. And so all the stuff I don't know, I know they know. And I know they are not going to crash the US economy. They know stuff. So I think this is like why it's a fun game and be on top of it and also understand when smart people on Bloomberg say dumb stuff, okay, they're being bribed by the Chinese or forced to say that. So, you know, that's the alpha for us as investors and Tesla holders or general shareholders. That's how you make money, by understanding, okay, this is actually stupid. And often it's about days or hours. But if you panic Sunday night, if you panic this morning, it's like, oh, it's down 5%, sell everything. It's like, well, guess what? Next minute, it's up 2% because of that. So,
and what's funny, actually, yeah. before I give it to Hans here, NASDAQ's up 1% right now.
And so. That's father, it's crazy because it went up on fake news, I think up from -5 to +2 because they said Trump is postponing. Then, he's not postponing. Then it dropped to -0.9 and now it's up. So
crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. I think the market is saying that, never mind. This is, this is exactly where we came into the weekend. That's where we are today. Like, there's not really anything new and substantive to change positioning on. And I really love that you brought up the power dynamics internal in China, Joe, because I think that that is such an important thing for people to appreciate. That I know that we like to have these cartoon ideas in our head about what it means to be a dictator of, a major global power and underestimate the complexities of what it takes to survive in a position like that and how tenuous everything is. And when you combine that with the fact that there are some, major benefits to having a state-directed capitalist economy where you can say, hey, we would just want to go out here and we want to own batteries. We just want to go out here and we want to own humanoid robotics. But they fail to appreciate that you introduce fragility into your economy when you do that. And I think that not doing that makes the US economy a lot more robust and resilient in these times of uncertainty relative to China. And that, it's like you can pick, hey, we want to win in these things. What does that come at the cost of? Well, maybe it comes at the cost of major real estate crises or debt crises or a lot of other things. And so the ability of, my big fear in all of this is that even though I have a lot of faith in Trump's ability to manage the knowns and the unknowns and understand the leverage back and forth between the US and China and then all of these secondary relationships with all of the other nations, like, I think he can do that fairly well. I am somewhat concerned about his ability to then think about second and third order consequences of all of those many variables in a way that isn't going to cause some sort of a major supply shock here in the United States that's destabilizing. But in that world, am I more worried about his ability to do that, or am I more worried about Xi's ability to do that? And then when you think about it in that comparative relative framework, then I'm way more worried about Xi's ability to manage second and third order consequences compared to Trump and the administration, especially when you take that and then go one step further and say, hey, if your CEOs, if you're sending Jack Ma to get re-educated when he tells you things that you don't want to hear, that means that you don't have him to give you information that you need in a situation like this. And then you look at the Trump administration and you've got Bessent and Lutnick and Elon and Sachs and all these people that you've mentioned who are absolute killers. They are sharp as a tack. They have experience. They have done the real things. I think the information ecosystem that the Trump administration lives in is a much richer information ecosystem than the one that Xi lives in. And Xi's willingness to sacrifice supply chain resilience or maybe economic resilience to achieve some specific outcomes in some specific areas just makes it a much more difficult position for them.
So can I play devil's advocate there for a second? Number one, you said sharp as a tack. So that's an immediate disqualifier. I'm kidding. So I agree. But what do you think about Elon's sort of commentary in the last couple of days about him coming out and saying, this is somebody in his administration saying, hey, we should go, we need to go to no tariffs. We need to go no tariffs, say, between EU and America. It seems like there's a little bit of hey, Trump, slow down. How do you perceive that?
Well, I think that was very interesting because, again, I had a bunch of commentary on that on X, and it's like, oh, there's a fight. Elon, what's the opposite of Trump? So I think we need to understand two things. Number one, these tariffs are mostly about China because China is the problem. That's the national security problem. That's also the economics problem. I have this chart in my video where I show Europe and the United States. They are sitting in the same boat, but Europe is getting ripped off even more than the United States, right? So they're going down and China and India are going up. So that's the imbalance here. So Europe is a natural ally in this whole thing, even though the European leadership is horrible. I think when we really think this through, what Elon is saying and what Trump is doing and saying doesn't contradict each other. It's actually just on different points on the timeline. Elon is further down. Trump is further here. Because let's assume you want what Elon wants. I want that. Maybe even Trump wants that. But how do you get there with all these unfair trade practices of the European Union? Not by going there and proposing that, because they're just going to trick their little things. First, you need pressure. And I think Elon is actually bad. That's the one thing Elon is not good at, because he doesn't want to be good at it. Elon is not a zero-sum guy. Elon is the opposite. Elon is a pioneer. Elon says, oh, well, let's not fight over this. Just create 10 million times more and then we are all happy. That's Elon's thinking. Whereas Trump comes from the zero-sum world. It's like, well, there's one building. I want it and you are not going to get it. Now, neither one is purely right or wrong. Both is right. Like the more you are in the current state, the more you deal with annoying other politicians, the more Trump is just the right mode of thinking. And the more you think into the future, Elon is the right mode. But they are not mutually exclusive. You need Trump now to get to where Elon wants to be. So, you know, I think the outcome of all of that, I had this in my first video on Saturday, is probably lower tariffs and more free trade worldwide in 1 year, in 2 years, in 4 years because of that. Because Trump is enforcing fair trade and balanced trade. And once everyone has their tariffs in place, then everyone's going to say, ooh, that's kind of dumb. Shouldn't we just take down the tariffs? Yes, but you cannot get there if you have zero tariffs and they all have tariffs here. They say, why would we change anything? You already have zero.
So how do you read the administration's, for the last few months, Lutnick, Bessent, you know, Trump, but primarily Lutnick and Bessent, specifically Lutnick, talking about, hey, the tariffs are a way to raise revenue. The tariffs are going to go in. We're going to get $1 trillion. Realistically, probably closer to $300 billion, $600 billion, whatever the number is. But this is going to be a legitimate, it's the external revenue service, right? It's the ERS. We're going to be able to get money. Now, if there is a significantly more free trade environment where there's like zero to zero traffic tariffs, or let's say something a little bit more fair, doesn't that dramatically impact the U.S.'s ability to raise revenue? Because go ahead.
That's a great question, Farzad. So I love this whole thing because it's truly 4D chess. It's kind of 2D chess, right, if you're a chess player. Because if you play chess, not that I play chess very well, but the basic principle of chess is you have your little pawns and you have little figures. I don't even know all the words. But the trick is if you have your figure one, you know, I just know the German names for it, but the tower and then the other guys and they do stuff. You want to basically place your pieces in a way that each piece exerts multiple dimensions of pressure, right? You want to make sure I'm threatening attack with this guy, but
and
also
defends your position too.
Exactly. Defense and has multiple angles of attack and together they do that. So what does it have to do with this? Normally these commentaries, you know, always aim at like, oh, for example, you're saying Trump wants to crash the market, so bonds go up and yields go down, so he can refinance $6 trillion in debt. Oh, that's so stupid. Do you really think he's going to crash the market just to get this done? Well, the answer is, well, he crashes the market, oil goes down, inflation goes down. You know, everyone, now we can get mortgages because of lower yields. All the costs in the United States go down because of lower oil, right? Lower oil also undermines Russia. So you are better off in dealing with Ukraine. These are not one-dimensional measures. The way it works, it's a complex matrix. And you're Trump, and you have 50 variables or 20 variables. And all you think is that variable, should it go up or down to make me stronger? What about oil? Up or down to make me stronger? What about external revenue? Up or down to make me stronger? And then you know all your metrics. Should they go up or down? Then you do X. You make a move. And you simulate all the metrics. It's like, well, I get more revenue, but I get higher oil. That's bad. That's good. Okay, let's see. Oh, now I figured out a trick where all my metrics move in the right direction. Now, do I only do it to get one of these metrics? No, but I can simulate now. It's like, well, if I make this move, every little lever goes into the right direction. I don't even care how much. It's just a good move. I don't even know what happens next, but all the levers go in the right direction. So when it comes to revenue, it's also not a single mono lever dimension, right? It's saying like, well, of course I want more revenue. But if you tell me they could make a move the other side to decrease my new tariff revenue by giving me shit tons of new factories and shifting all the production into the United States, that decreases my revenue here, but it maximizes my revenue here. Now I make income tax. I make all kinds of tax here. That's good. I don't care if you a trick to get my, if I do a move that suddenly gives me tariff revenue and your only option to take that away from me is to shift massive revenue inside the United States, well, be my guest. I'm better off in both cases because the only way to remove that is to give me another huge advantage. So that's how we have to think about it. It's not about these single variables, it's about setting up the chessboard. So I put you in a position where you can, if you take that away from me, you have to give me even more on the other side. And that's exactly what tariffs are. If I impose all these tariffs on you and you make sure my tariff revenue is zero, I want even more. Because that means you shifted everything inside the United States.
And I would just add to that, I think that Bessent really tipped his hand a little bit for those of us who are paying attention on, you know, maybe what are some of the higher order of those metrics. And I think real wages and purchasing power of the vast majority, you know, the bottom 50% of Americans is one of the most important set of metrics. And so when you say, you know, hey, like oil prices went down, well, is that something that's going to have a positive impact on more Americans or fewer Americans? It's more. And it's
exactly
disproportionately the people that Trump really wants to advantage the most in all of these moves. And so I think that that's something to, for those of us who are trying to decode all this and make sense of it, I think that is, they've told us what it is that they value. And I think we should take them seriously on that.
And also, yeah. I think there's like this face value, you know, talk of them. It's like, look, the rich have enough money now. And like, you know, this is not about Wall Street, it's about Main Street. I think they are 50% honest about it, that this actually benefits Main Street. Of course, what they're dishonest about is like Wall Street always wins. Like, of course, the stocks go through the roof with this strategy. But they're using that hiccup to actually make this point to the majority of voters who actually benefit from, even if the stock goes down, from the other things. But it's very clear to me that it's not that the people who do their European fancy vacations that they refer to or all their friends, it's not that they're going to get poor with this strategy, which is good. But I mean, the capital owners will win very big on top of it too. Only this time they are right that average Americans, the bottom 50% who don't have savings and don't have stocks, of course they benefit from lower yields. They benefit from lower Fed rates. They benefit from lower oil. And they hugely benefit from shifting this stuff back into the United States with this double whammy, bringing $5 trillion of investments and construction of factories into the United States. And of course, new jobs because you're shifting to American businesses.
So what do you make of the point that I've seen online kind of floating around that the market, specifically a bunch of the banks, hedge funds and stuff, were potentially over leveraged and that maybe this reset was a way to get them to delever so that we didn't have an 08-09 type crisis in the financial markets?
Well, I think it's always healthy. You know, it's what doesn't kill you makes you stronger for the markets. I think shocks are always good as long as they don't end up in disaster, right? So you want to shock it as much as possible without killing it, which might happen. Like in 2008, that was close to killing, very close. And so I think this is always healthy. And I think anything that is unexpected, like Trump's move here, which breaks a lot of, you know, thinking patterns, increases resilience. It's like anti-fragility. You want to be anti-fragile. And shocks are good unless they're too big.
I think
you know, as I'm thinking through this, and this is something that I've been thinking through ever since really the, not only the tariffs were announced, but some of the moves he's been making before, some of his rhetoric. You know, like one of the things you mentioned before was there are a lot of people out there that say, oh, Trump is dumb. Like, Trump is dumb. This is stupid. This is sort of a
knee-jerk
reaction.
He's like very smart to say Trump is dumb. He's just randomly the president of it. It's like what they said about Bush too. I mean, Bush also came across pretty dumb. And I was like, this dude is just not dumb. You're just not dumb. I mean, you're not going to win these things.
Exactly. And to me, like one of my best friends, Keith, you know, I love him to death, but you know, he's fully on the camp and he'll be very honest about it. He's like, I think Trump is the dumbest person on, or one of the dumbest people. I'm like, I set aside the fact that he led one of the greatest political comebacks of all time. He's got a bunch of really bright people around him. So unless he's like the greatest scam artist of all time, and like we're living in the craziest time of all, right? It's very unlikely that.
But if you're a scam, I mean, this is a great philosophical debate. What is a scam artist? Yeah. If you win all the time, make everyone rich and win, are you a scam artist? I mean, you know, it's like what Einstein said: the difference between genius and madness is success, nothing else. And the difference between scamming and being a master entrepreneur is also success. If you're a scam artist, you scam everyone, and in the end, there's a new civilization, and we have flying cars. I mean. Did you scam them? Probably not.
And this is why this time is so interesting, is because I think this could very well apply. Is that this is one of those moments where if you really think about the United States and their policy and how they've operated just in general, and this is typically a public sector thing, a government thing, they've been maximum status quo, maximum risk off. And with Trump, it's maximum risk on. And just YOLO, right? Just like, they're like, here are the things that we have to do. You only live once.
Well, it's maybe, you could argue, maybe it's not even YOLO. Maybe it's not risk on. Maybe it's actually like Elon operates. It's actually very low risk. It's just a deeper understanding.
Well, that's my point. That's my point I'm trying to make. That's exactly it. There has to be something else going on here. I don't buy the thesis that this is a knee-jerk reaction. It's non-calculated. He's completely clueless about it. I do think that he has some very, very basic principles that he's operating on. It's China. The world has been over-reliant on China. COVID exposed it. The United States has been hollowed out from the middle. We need to bring stuff back, okay? And then there's a gigantic artificial intelligence boom where the winner that's able to capitalize on this will win huge. So these are the three primary things going on. And we need to figure out how to create movement towards this, right? And all of this, specifically even maybe the tariff thing more than anything, could be those forcing functions that are trying to get the United States in that position. My big fear is for this to work, it has to come to a resolution fairly quickly. Because my fear is if this is up in the air for more than, say, 4 to 6 weeks, for the primary variables that you need to capitalize on, and we've already seen some movement, right? The EU has openly said we'll go 0-0. Vietnam has said we'll go 0-0. Taiwan 0-0. Israel 0-0. Like, there are players coming forward, but my fear is if you don't nip this in the bud relatively quickly by the end of May, this could spiral completely out of control. And so, what are the forcing functions? What are the things that need to be done in order to get this done to a quick resolution? Because if it doesn't come to a quick resolution, there's way too much uncertainty, too many balls in the air. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a brilliant point, Farzad. I think you're absolutely right. I would share that 100%. If this is up in the air even 4 weeks, you will have real repercussions on investment, on planning, on then you are moving towards a recession, because that's a second order effect of that. But here's why I'm very confident about it. It's a very ballsy move. If you're a little emotional, but if you're just cold-blooded putting the numbers together, which I think they did, you know, it's a very calculated risk. Because what they did is so bold and brutal that they know China is going to implode within 4 weeks. I'm not even kidding. China cannot withstand this. And so they put the ball in their court. You know, the clock might be ticking for Trump, but the clock is much faster ticking for Xi. And so I said in my video, I have a high conviction that China is going to cave on fentanyl quickly this week, probably. Even though I don't know I mean, there is risk.
And if that happens, that's a signal, right? If that happens, I mean, that's a signal.
That's a domino effect. And another thing, just even though it's more of a sideshow, but it's an interesting side to Germany, who has the lead in Europe, and Habeck, who is the economic minister of Germany, who's one of my favorite dummies in the EU. He's like a children's book author. He's a Green Party dude. These people are such an embarrassment. So many of my German friends, they're like, they can't even talk about it. Such an embarrassment. It's like the feminist, all these feminist governments like Sweden and Annalenchen Baerbock in Germany, we are feminists, we are pride feminists.
And just for the audience, you're in Finland, correct?
Right now, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
I'm doing a lip tour. So,
yeah.
I mean, these people, and then they always put the, what is these Muslim wheels on them when they visit Iran, and they totally bash them. They think these stupid little subhuman women people there, let's show them who's boss. And then they do everything they want because they're feminists. They have like empathy, I guess, for douchebags. I don't even understand, right? So, you know, no Iranian woman who fled that state would ever even consider that. They would think, no,
100%.
You go there and you show them what's going on. If you are the foreign minister of Germany, are you kidding me? So anyway, so these people are annoying. And Habeck said, because he's feckless and stupid, on Saturday, this is like war. What Trump did is similar to what Putin did to Ukraine. He literally said this, like the economic minister. And we will teach him a lesson and we show him retaliation. I was like, dude, I can't even put this into words, you little dummy. And today, he already got completely reined in by someone in Germany. He's like, well, it's important that we don't do anything too fast and we are very considerate with this situation. So you already see they're all falling apart. The risk in China is, as I said, as Zelensky example, I don't know what's behind the scenes is going on. Is she in a situation where he simply can't do that? I don't know what's going on. But Trump probably knows much more, and the CIA and everyone, it's probably just a huge inconvenience and some risk. And what Trump did now is a bigger risk to Xi. I think she has now to weigh, okay, do I root these people out and just make sure I can get it done with some personal risk? Or do I get eliminated? Because if China implodes, she has to go, or worse. So,
yeah.
I think you can also tell when you talk with the Europeans, they're all like these people, it's like the Canadians. What I don't even know what to say. But in China, it's like Putin, right? There's a whole different vibe. It's like, okay, this is about life and death, and these people are not dummies. And it's a whole different level of seriousness. So I think, to your point, I think the forcing function is already in place. The forcing function is, we just did something to you that will annihilate your entire economy within 6 weeks. So the ball is in your court.
And the only way for China to really escape this, theoretically, is to try and bring people out of the U.S. sphere into their sphere, right? So it's like the equation becomes, okay, who? So then now that this chaos is unfolding, if you're, say, Europe, as an example, or whichever other major economy, do I want to continue a relationship with, am I more aligned with Trump in this case? And like, if we're going to use a little bit of like devil's advocate here or whatever, or the realistic thing that's going on, it's the equation is, okay, so take Trump's worst traits, let's say, from their perspective, chaotic, unpredictable. I don't know if I can trust him. He changes his mind too fast. He's too brutal. He's not really honorable, et cetera, et cetera.
He's rude.
Too much chaos. He's rude, whatever.
He's rude.
So do I want to deal with him, even though I know he's got the strongest, most solid, most free economy and democracy that exists on the earth? Or do I partner with China, given, you know, their totalitarian government, but they have embraced some sort of entrepreneurship, their manufacturing base is out there. So if you're somebody that the U.S. has been having a relationship with now, the equation is, do you trust Trump or do you trust China? But I think that's what that works to Trump's advantage, is because he knows America is America. He knows America is America, regardless of what Trump is. Trump is just, in my opinion, using the leverage he has, which is the American economy, to force everybody to make a decision. And the decision's either me or China. Pick one. And
exactly.
It's very unlikely that they'll choose
also
China
even,
over.
Yeah. Even if they choose, so I will go into Europe in a second, but even if anyone chooses China, we're talking about 6 weeks. Like, you can't get anything done.
Exactly.
You have to cave. You have to cave now, and then you can plot your revenge. you know, for years, and maybe something comes out of that. You can reposition and realign, but you can't do it in 6 weeks. And
he has forced everyone's hand. Everyone's hand is being forced, including the United States.
Yeah. Exactly. And, you know, when it comes to Europe, I'm very, you know, again, what's true for dictatorships that Zelensky and Putin and Xi cannot just do stuff. They're dependent on complex underlying structures. It's much more complex in the US, same principle, but even more complex. And it's even more complex in Europe because this is like a shit show, right? No one is in charge and everything is like, they can't even coordinate. That can be a strength.
Joe, I love you, bro.
But it's funny. But it's these people. You also have to understand the European Union. Ursula von der Leyen, she's in a very weak position. Everything flows from Germany. If Germany falls in the hands of the alt-right or whatever that is, the new alternative, Europe is going to disintegrate and going to get restructured under MAGA, not MAGA, Make Europe Great Again. And the AfD is now even with the Christian Democrats. So the fake conservative Rhino party, which was the biggest, is now even with the new alternative party, which Elon, you know, the AfD, Elon supports. And most people don't even know that. They are now head to head in Germany. And the new government isn't being formed. And they have enormous problems because there's enormous public pressure now on this whole negotiation. So this whole thing might implode. And we have elections again, or the CDU actually forms some form of weird minority government with the AfD and gives them power. So we are that close. And that is all happening while these tariffs are happening. So if Habeck does something stupid and tells Ursula to tell Trump something stupid, they are deteriorating even more as we speak. At the same time, they made the Le Pen move, the, you know, put Trump in jail move in New York, they did in Paris and said, oh, why don't we put the leading force for the opposition that has now the majority of all votes for the presidential election 2027 in France, like a right winger. Why don't we put her in jail? So they did that. Oh, you can't run anymore. The judge says you're out. And now are these giant protests, right, in France. Even the French wake up now. They stop smoking, drink some cappuccino and say, oh, merde, this is bad. And then now they're doing something. So this is happening in Germany and in France at the same time. So you are on very thin ice internally if you do stupid stuff. And so the Trump administration is not dumb. I think J.D. Vance is the secret, like, ambassador to Europe that does all these things. And Elon is there, right, talking to the Italians. They're already. So that's the exciting thing. This is like really 50D chess, right? You're not just dealing with the European Union. You're dealing with the secondary layer of revolution that's going on there that's just waiting to kill these people. And they're all now winning. So if they do one wrong move, they're not losing to America. They're losing their own to their own countries. And then Trump absolutely wins if that happens.
And I wonder how much of these, like, and that's such a rundown of all the different, because all of this does, I mean, if we are to assume that he knows what he's doing, which I believe that's the case, then absolutely every single one of these variables would play into that decision 100%, because it's part of, that's, yes, part of your leverage. That's part of your calculus that says, I know what position you're in. And so the like for you to not come along with me is going to be hugely detrimental to you. I'm just forcing your hand. And that's, and I think that's the part of the discomfort. And that's why people don't like Trump, is because he forces hands. He is very good at forcing your hand. He knows what he's got, and he's going to try to, and that's why they call him the king, because you have to bend the knee. But if you think about it,
don't
from
call
a,
him the king, father. You will have a,
don't call him the king.
Meltdown.
I'm sorry. Yes.
Oh my God, he wants to be king. Even worse.
But I think that's the negative aspect of Trump. The positive aspect of this whole thing is that you can't ignore global trends. You can't ignore the downward trend of the United States' manufacturing capacity, their health outcomes, their over-reliance on China, even more so on the European Union. The West has been in legitimate turmoil and on a downward trend for decades. And that's impossible to ignore. And so the equation becomes like, how big of a thing do I have to do to reverse the trend? And if this trend has been going on for decades, it would be silly for us to think that you can do this over the course of 20 years to reverse, because the United States is a democracy. every 2 years, Congress or the presidential.
Please.
Yeah.
Because you're saying something very smart that is exactly here. I just want to support what you're saying with this one chart. See this chart?
Yeah, exactly. This is GDP based on PPP, share of world, percent of world, right? So this base, purchasing power, right?
PPP, exactly. That's what parity, it stands for. Yeah. So it's parity purchasing power. So we can compare these. And here you have Western Europe. They lost the most. Then you have America. They also lost. And then you have China taking over and India. That's all you need to know. From 1980 to 2020, that's just 40 years. Total decline of Western Europe, also decline of the United States, and crazy rise of China. And once you understand, this is not just because the Chinese work harder, are smarter, and we are all dumb, even though Chinese are amazing people that do great stuff. But great, it's not just based. It's not just based on that. It is based on cheating too, on massive cheating. And Trump says, we cannot, this is the big picture. This cannot continue. That's our civilization, and Europe's too, by the way.
Exactly. And so for us, and I'll throw it to Hans here in a second, for us to reverse this trend, in theory, it's unrealistic to do this over the course of years or decades because of how quickly the hands change in the United States democracy. Every 2 years, you're going to have a flip of some sort, or there's potential for a flip. So the derailment of momentum happens all the time. And so realistically, for something to happen, to actually change course, it has to happen very, very quickly, and it has to be gigantic. But with that comes gigantic risk, which is if you don't execute on this at a high level and you're miscalculating your hand, it will blow up in your face and it could cause a bigger problem. You're basically accelerating the demise instead of trying to reverse the trend. And that's, I mean, and I don't think it's hyperbolic to say that the next 4 to 6 weeks, that's literally what's going to happen to the United States. We're either going to accelerate the demise or we're going to reverse trend. That's what it feels like. Go ahead, Hans.
Yeah, I would say that the big thing there is that, yes, it is extremely risky for us, but part of Trump's genius is that he realized that it's as risky, if not more risky, for everyone else.
Exactly.
And so he is putting the deadline on them to deal with this in an even, like, this is going to be existential for Trump. So he wanted to set the deadline to make it existential for everyone else before it was existential for him. And so his choice to bring the timeline in and make all this stuff happen right now is the way that he is managing that risk. And I think that the way that they're pursuing this gambit definitely is well thought out. It is well planned, and it has a good chance of working because of those relative advantages. And then I did want to comment just briefly on the chart that you shared, which is a brilliant way to capture, I think, that chart is something that is also encapsulated in the wisdom of the silent majority, both in the United States and in Europe. And that wisdom of the silent majority, this underlying feeling of frustration with the way that the economy is working and the way that politics is working for everyday citizens who are not necessarily super connected and super well off. Like, that is what people term populism. And that populism is the thing that Trump has leaned into, as saying, you know what, actually, those people aren't dumb. Those people are smart, and they're right. And that chart shows exactly how they are smart and how they are right. And this is his gambit to fix that.
It's also this whole populism thing, also one of my favorite topics. Like, our democracies, I hate to say it, but the democracies are a scam. Because we are being told this is a democracy, and that implies the demos, the people, are, you know, they are ruling over their country. But, you know, what's happening in reality is that
until they want something that the elites don't want, and then it's like, screw you guys.
Exactly. And what I realized only very recently, I quantified this a little bit. What I realized is the problem. Here's the exact mechanical problem about democracy as a concept right now. That 80% of the population, you have 10% lunatics on the left, and then you have 10% on the right, of half of them are lunatics and the other half is just very well informed. And the 80% in the middle, I don't know the exact percentages, but the 80% in the middle, they are basically uninformed voters, and they fall into two categories. NPCs that you need to program because they will execute the program, but they don't understand it. They need to be programmed. And the other half are like, I would say smart soccer moms or something. They literally say, I don't have time for this shit. Tell me who is a Nazi and I'm not going to vote for him. So it's, they are not NPCs. They just say, dudes, I have kids. I have like other stuff to do. I can't like watch Joe and Farzad and Hans all day long. So, and I get it. Some people have a life, right? So that means 80% of the population relies on some form of media to tell them what to do. Half of them because they want to be told what to do and the other half because they don't have time. And that puts the media in a position that basically determines the outcome of democratic elections. And that's also what Trump meant, in my opinion, when he said it was rigged in 2020. And once you understand that, it's like, yeah, it was guaranteed 100% completely rigged. It was rigged in the sense that we rely on the media to give us some form of reality information, and it didn't. It just lied like in an insane, crazy, biased way, and that's why it was rigged. And I think to change that, we need a total overhaul of the media landscape. And the reason Trump won and the reason why America is so amazing is because it created this grassroots revolution of Joe Rogan and the resistance against the mainstream media that actually worked organic. And I think Europe is going to follow, but they're lagging. And that's why democracy technically is a scam. It's not a democracy. It's a mediocracy. I don't know.
That kind of fits.
No, it's a rule by the media. And so that is why X is so important, because we have to understand democracy is a second order problem. The first order is the people need to own the media.
Information.
That's not the case. It's game over. It's not a democracy.
I think that's such a brilliant observation, and something that I didn't really wake up to until I had this YouTube channel is I didn't really realize, and it kept growing and growing, and now it's at the point where I have, thank you to everybody watching and listening, one of my pride and joys is that I believe my audience is quite free thinking and they don't take everything as gospel. And of course, we'll have our biases, but I think my audience is able to think for themselves quite a bit. But I think it's very true that media has an unbelievable amount of power over the direction of democracies, to the point where, like, if you were to delete media and you said, okay, everybody fend for yourselves, the chances of, let's say, the Democrat Party for the last, I don't know, 8 to 10 years, their ability to get elected would probably go down to zero, because they shaped the narrative so much through media, through entertainment, et cetera, et cetera. Now that has become extremely obvious, but it was very difficult to analyze in the time because of how prevalent it was. You didn't know what you were living in at the time, right? And it didn't take me going through this media journey. Let me pick your brain on something real quick. What do you think of the India dynamic in this whole thing? Modi visited the US, I think it was a few weeks ago. He did a podcast with Lex. It seems like India is becoming more and more, they're definitely growing, they're the most populous country in the world right now, and they will be for probably forever at this point. They have a rising industry, they have rising ambitions, but the relationship between India and China, correct me if I'm wrong, it's been quite tense. And I wonder, how much of this do you think, is there a variable here being played where the U.S., wants to draw India closer to themselves through all these negotiations to try and isolate China even further? I don't know. It's just something that went through my head. Like, I wonder if that's also part of the equation. But
I think if you look at these super civilizations, Europe, the United States, India, and China, I think that's it. Maybe there's the Islamic civilization too that's roaming around, but they have some problems. It's very interesting. Obviously, China and India are arch rivals for over the last 3,000 years or something. So there's clearly this going on. But at the same time, it's a little different from what we were used in Europe, right? Including the United States, where you had like super strong, like Germany and France and UK and Italy and Spain, and they were just fighting it out all the time. I think China and India, they're not so much countries as they are vast civilizations, right? These are very complicated things. And it's more like all of Europe or something and America combined. And I think India has a lot of problems. So India has enormous potential, obviously, like human potential, historic, cultural potential, but they also have enormous problems. which makes them, you know, China, I think both of them have a history of being incredibly unstable. They're too big. They're impossible to govern. That's why China is so obsessed with harmony and centralization, because that's what they never, they tried it for 3,000 years and they have failed for 3,000 years. There's a reason for it. It's too complicated. And so I think they just randomly, you know, got the communist ideology and some modern technology. So that's why they are on this roll right now, but it's not going to last for the reasons I think Hans elaborated on. Like, you have to, you can't central plan an economy like this. You can do it in the beginning, but not now. And I think India didn't even get there and they will never get there. So I think India will remain a mess, but with so much potential and people roaming around that they will produce a lot of stuff, but it will never be, in my opinion, India will not become anytime soon very strong. So as a block. And so it's a great market. You can sell into the market, even though it's low price. My prediction on this whole thing is China is going to destabilize and the story of China is over. That is my prediction. Not over in the sense they are going away, but their rise has ended. They are going to be where they are. They are now going to be in a low growth situation for a very long time, and they are going to destabilize. That is my prediction. Not implode, but they will, I think they will not make it much more to the
top.
They've peaked, right? Because now they have a lot of problems. And my prediction is that something that no one is anticipating is going to happen. And I'm very bullish on the United States, but the United States also have deep structural problems. I think for me, the United States is brilliant in leveraging and utilizing its potential. So basically, each of these big things has a lot of, has potential and utilization of potential. I think Europe, by enormous distance, has the highest potential, and by enormous distance, the worst utilization rate. Like in Germany or France, like the lower you get socially, the more intelligent the people become. Like that's not how it's supposed to be. In the US, it's the reverse, right? The senators are all like super smart and the CEOs are smart. In Germany, every little teacher in a local school can build you a nuclear weapon or something, but they say, oh, it's just, if you want power and money, you're bad. So you have all the smart people at the bottom, kind of, and all the dumb people on the top, like Habeck. And I have to bash this guy. So yeah, and like the Germans are basically brilliant in nearly everything except for three jobs: politicians, bankers, and managers. And the problem is, if you put your worst people into these three jobs, it's not very good for your country because these are important jobs. But people look down on these jobs like, ooh, you're a politician. Ee, you're a banker. That's a criminal. Ooh, you're a manager. That's an evil capitalist. So all the smart people stay away from it.
They have think the EU has huge potential here. You think that they're the surprise of the next 40, 50
well,
years?
Well, because of, I think because of cultural changes that people get tired now in Europe, especially the young. There's this big right-wing shift with the young people. There's like, I've had it. What's even happening? This is a mismanagement. They're taking away my future. I've had it. I want to be successful. I want to do something now. That's a new trend. And because of the restructuring of Europe, that's going to happen very soon. Because what Europe needs is decentralization. Like Europe's strength was always that it was a patchwork. You had tremendous competition between thousands of little kingdoms. That's how they became by an enormous distance as number one. Like there's some random German town in a forest with their own little king. They developed some swords and then the British did something and they exchanged it and then they fought a little bit all the time. So if Europe goes back to a more competitive patchwork situation where you decentralize, right? So everyone becomes competitive. If you do something stupid in your little state, I just leave. Like in the United States, but it could even be on steroids. Then Europe will become very strong and their main disadvantage is centralized bureaucracy, and the second disadvantage is way too expensive for wages. That's why I'm so bullish about Tesla Optimus and this whole thing and AGI. Because imagine what happens once Optimus goes to scale in 2029, I assume, or 2028, where this really starts to work very well. What happens to the world? Like all the countries right now that have an advantage in low wages have no advantage anymore. And all the countries who have the highest IP, the highest innovation power, they will dominate. Imagine you can go to Sweden or Finland or Norway and tell them you have unlimited labor for free. Do you know what happens next? Do you know what these people get done if you're in some Swedish village and everyone is like smart and everything just works all the time, but they just don't have people, or they have to pay them $200,000 a year to drive buses? So it's like there will be a massive shift back into the most developed countries, which includes Japan and South Korea, by the way. So imagine they have cheap labor, endless amounts of cheap, precise labor. So I think there will be a surprise twist to the game. And that will happen in the next 5 years, I think. So
I think, yeah. Go ahead, sorry.
And then one last thing, when you put, because I'm kind of American and European at the same time, so I like both, but I see these tremendous weird differences that they come out in a similar position kind of. But the US is just way better as a system. You know, it's very clear for anyone who thinks straight to see what the huge advantages of America over Europe are. But when you're on the ground, I was just in Austin. Austin is great. But, you know, if you go through Texas and then you are in Estonia or something, or in Norway, the level of civilizational infrastructure on the ground, just pragmatically, you go into a store or you meet people or you go to a music festival or something, it's just infinitely higher in Europe. That's the interesting thing. Every single person is just so much more educated and competent, at least in Northern Europe, that it's shocking. They're just not doing anything with it. But I think they are slowly realizing this is just stupid. And, you know, once you introduce competition. So I think from a potential level, Europe is still by far the number one. If you just look at infrastructure, also intellectual, cultural infrastructure, what do people know? What's the competence level? If you tell this person do something, they just get it all done. So Europe, you know, is it better to sit on a giant pile of assets in a company and the management is horrible? Would you buy that company as private equity, or would you buy the most brilliant management with no assets? It's like, well, I would buy the huge assets with stupid management because it's easier to change the management than to, you know, create assets. So
yeah,
not that the US has no assets, but you know what I mean. It's just when I'm on the ground.
No, I think I appreciate the take. I mean, I think that's a very bullish and I think a logical thesis for Europe. I mean, it makes a lot of sense. I would also say that I think what America has going for it that I don't think is well understood by many. And I'm not saying this applies to you, but I mean like people outside of the United States that don't live here. I think there's a lot of people here. There's 330 million people, 350 million, whatever the number is. But we are so unbelievably spread out. So the thing is, like, when you go from town to town, city to city, region to region, you get these insane amounts of like variability between regions. But I think the one thing that has stayed true for America for a long time is that there's still a lot of will and sort of like passion to get stuff done. That's hard to quantify. That's part of the spirit. Yeah. That I'm not saying Europe doesn't have, but that's like the piece that always gets sort of miscalculated.
It's a very interesting question, because what you're pitting against each other, these assets, it's a great discussion, but I never hear anyone discuss this. It's like super interesting.
Yeah.
You are pitting basically the two strengths against each other and ask which one will win. And of course, US is totally winning and Europe is totally not winning really right now. But
I think the bigger variable, Joe, is that I think who loses is China, even in that scenario.
I'm pretty sure. Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Go ahead. So I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
But, you know, when I look at America, what is the best of America? Like, of course, there are absolutely amazing things. When I see, like, you know, successful entrepreneurs or like some Midwesterner who built this thing, it's just perfect. The whole thing is perfect in my mind. It's a perfect pioneer, perfect company. They did everything right. What scares me in the United States, if you go into, you know, I mean, look at California, I was in Portland recently. I was frequently in Portland, and you go into the hinterland. It's just, it's like not in good shape. And America has like the culture of success, the will to success, a lot of knowledge about entrepreneurship and the right attitude that I will do what it takes, which is extremely valuable. But what Europe has on a much deeper integrated level is just vast amounts of competence and knowledge. And that's that's what I don't see in the United States. Like, you will have a bunch of competent people somewhere in Stanford, but quite frankly, I don't want to sound like that or anything, but if I go to a better, to a top 10% German high school, everyone can do what they do in Stanford, right? It's crazy. I'm not even exaggerating. And in Sweden, don't get me started. Like, these
people, the education in the US is not good.
It's not good. And I was, when I was first time in Harvard, talked to a philosophy professor, like, dude, that's like 11th grade high school stuff you're doing here in grad school and philosophy in Harvard. So, but the problem is the Germans or Swedes, they don't do anything with it. It's like, well, now I'm super smart. Now I become an elementary school teacher. It's like, that's stupid. But so the question is, so clearly America is more winning than Europe. But for me, as a civilization building exercise, would I rather have the Americans and try to add the European piece, or would I have the Europeans and add the American piece? I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. But just in terms of intellect, effort, like, I wouldn't even know where to start in the United States. Okay, I have to build an entire, I don't even know what, like an educational mega infrastructure to reach every American. It's impossible. I don't know how.
In Europe, why do you need that when you have artificial intelligence? You just have artificial intelligence. Why do you need to build it?
Sure, but that's like, it's going to take some time to get this into every brain and everything. So in Europe, maybe I'm wrong, but I think this American can-do spirit and all the strengths of America are easier. I just envision myself, if I'm the trainer, would I rather get into a Swedish high school and shake these people a little bit up and say, you little losers, do you really want to be losers and never do anything? I think I could turn them around pretty quickly. If you sent me to like in Detroit inner city school, it's like, okay, you can't shake them up. They already have that spirit. They just have no knowledge. And then
my argument is, in the age of AI, knowledge is going to be easier to gain than work ethic.
Yeah, but it's not like shallow knowledge, right? This goes very deep. It's like this entire thing, like the attitude of like competence, of diligence, of thinking things through. This
just
is not
ask
like,
the AI, tell me what to do, and they'll do it.
Maybe. I want to pause for a second before we move on to the AI topic, because I'm actually totally would take the opposite trade of Joe on this one. I think that what you're describing, to me, sounds like a consequence of just the robustness of the social welfare system in Europe, that we have raised the floor so high that you can be an incredibly smart person and live such an incredibly comfortable life without actually achieving anything meaningful, that it removes that motivation. I think that the comfort with having these, you know, much wider gaps between the people who have something and the people who don't have something here in the United States, that it is that gap that creates the motivation to do all of the crazy things that end up getting accomplished here, especially when you have such a system that is able to bring, you know, those people that are smart from wherever they are to a place like San Francisco in the past, maybe that's Austin moving forward, wherever that is, and then give them the tool set that they need to just achieve incredible things. I really think that cultural piece is a harder piece to overcome. Like, if you were going to ask me, who would I bet on right now, Google or a company like Anduril that has way better culture, way fewer assets, but they understand the lay of the land. They are just incredibly motivated. The leadership and the incentive structure is perfect. I'm going to bet on Anduril every time, and I'm going to fade Sundar Pichai.
Oh,
like,
me too.
I don't care who you
replace. Google is infected by the woke mind virus.
Yes, and well, their incentive structure is also woefully broken. And I mean, I guess it's not impossible to fix. You are correct in that. Like, Microsoft would be an example. Microsoft under Ballmer versus Microsoft under Satya is, you know, two different companies. And the capability of what Microsoft can do under Satya once they fix all of the culture and all of the incentives and get on the right path strategically is very, very, very impressive. And so, you know, I think there's positive examples that you can look at in either scenario.
And I think Farzad is right. Like, this is a debate where I'm like 60-40, 60% convinced that Europe might be easier to tune up than America in terms of, but I would say America is winning right now. But if you give me the task, we fix both up, I would say I would have an easier time fixing the European problems than fixing the American problems. But I think they're very similar. And there's a lot of, I mean, with X, with English becoming really like a main communication language also in Scandinavia and in Germany now on X, where people just switch to and it's like, okay, I've had it. I want to just communicate with everyone. I think there's a lot of, this is going to level, getting more level, which is good. To Elon's point, this is a united culture, right? And I think what we learned the hard way is I have great respect for, I have a lot of Chinese friends. So I have a great respect for, and also India. It's just much more alien on a much deeper level than Europe to America. And people, especially Americans, sometimes they discount, ah, whatever, they're all the same. It's just humans, just import them.
It's because they've never traveled abroad. They're
travel to Beijing and Shanghai and then travel to Berlin and London and you will see it's not the same. It's just different. And so to Farzad's point, maybe I'm biased, obviously, but I am bullish
too.
On the West. I'm bullish on the West.
Exactly. Me too. And I think that's the overarching thing here is like to tie back to the whole discussion is like, and based on what's coming in the age of artificial intelligence and robotics specifically and humanoid robots, when the cost of labor per hour, you'll be able to have something significantly cheaper than a human in China built in the United States with a humanoid robot. That breaks everything. Now, China's going to be able to do that as well. China's going to be able to make their own humanoid robots, but which country is going to have a more useful humanoid robot, right? To me, it's the West. It's specifically the United States and specifically Tesla, because they are the ones with the data. They're the ones with the know-how. They're the ones with the processes. They're the ones with the whole ecosystem needed to have an extremely useful robot everywhere. And if you're able to do that at scale, you delete China's entire advantage, which is massive human capital to make stuff.
And well, if and that India's, no longer... And all kinds of countries, yeah.
Exactly. And so that's the premise. So, okay, so under that scenario, which in theory, every country wins under that scenario because you're freeing up everyone's time.
Well, I'm a little bit like Farzad on this side. You know, I like to be right about the future because people ask, are you optimistic, pessimist, blah, blah, blah. I want to be right because that's important. And then we can form an opinion. What do we want to do? We need to accurately simulate without bias. What's going to happen? And so I think I clearly see a vastly dystopian outcome too. And it's going to be, you know, the tale of two cities.
100%.
It's the best of all times and the worst of all times. And I think the idea that everyone wins is just stupid. Like, of course, there will be no age of abundance and everyone wins. We already live in an age of abundance. You can give everyone everything right now, but guess what? We are not doing it. How would that be different in the future? Do you think, oh, because now we have enough for everyone. We already have enough for everyone. But guess what? Yeah. It's not getting to the people because the people who have it don't give it to them. And I don't think that's going to change. It's going to get worse. So I think there will be winners and losers, and there will be massive amounts of losers and also massive amounts of winners. And it's going to be a mindset problem. Are you a pioneer? Are you someone who understands this is all gone now? And the future, we can just do whatever we want. But if you don't want anything and you don't know how to deploy knowledge and capital, you're just going to you're going to perish. It's going to be bad. And everyone in theory can become a pioneer, right? You just watch Farzad's channel. It's like, oh, that's how you do it. You know,
don't do that.
Like envision the future and start building it and fail and learn and repeat until you succeed. But I mean, that's easier said than done for a lot of people. And it's, you know, so, I mean, it's going to be very interesting, the future.
Yeah, I think that's the most, yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that's a very realistic take, like to assume that humans are going to stop humaning in the next 5, 10, 20 years when it comes to power and leverage and wanting to win. And of course, like the human condition does seem to always go up towards more and more people seem to be winning, let's say, as a total percentage share, but there's widening gaps. They're like, you're either winning really hard or you're losing really hard. And that gap seems to be getting bigger and bigger. So, and I think that the question the ultimate question becomes, I mean, it's just, see, like part of me doesn't want that future, obviously, because I hate the thought of people living in a post AI world that don't win and are living in complete and abject poverty, and they just, and let's say whatever the worst case, or you know, some sort of like 1000% of the time plugged in into a VR headset,
exactly,
and getting an IV. Right,
invest in video game companies. They will definitely win.
They're gonna kill. Yeah. So is that it? But in the end, like I think your viewpoint is like, you know, we can want whatever we want. The biggest question is what's going to happen. What is the likeliest scenario?
And this is also what we have to learn from. I mean, why Elon is so brilliant, and we have to learn from Elon to take the Elon thinking and apply this entire paradigm to humans. Because Elon does it with material, with physics, with rockets. There's also the same thing Elon does with humans. And, you know, we have to analyze humans first principles as if they were, you know, as if we are not emotionally involved to understand what's happening. And then we can think, okay, but if we don't like this, what's the path? Otherwise, you run into the communist trap. Like Lenin planned it all out. It was gonna be a paradise, but something went wrong. So
yeah, understanding what's actually happening gives you the chance to actually like change the trend in case of a bad scenario.
And to understand the first principles of humans and their societies before you judge it, before you put in what you want. First, you have to learn what will they do? And that Trump is very good at that. He said, well, it's not what I want. It's like, what will they do under what circumstance? Then I think what I want, what do I have to do to make it all come to the right outcome?
Yeah. Dude, great discussion. Wow. This was so, we have to have you back, Joe. This was excellent. And I'm glad it kind of happened like this, sort of like randomly. We were supposed to have somebody.
It was very spontaneous here, directly from far north to Austin. You're like the best ad for Austin, the background.
Yeah. Yeah, man. I'm at Capital Factory today. But we'll definitely have you back. Because you're one of the, just watching your commentary is really eye opening because, you know, I think, again, none of us know really what's happening. We can just best understand what could happen, understand the variables at play here. I do believe that your thesis and the way you're thinking about it specifically is the likeliest. But I think, again, we will know for sure in the next 4 to 6 weeks. Like either this discussion materializes, or I don't know.
I'm going to lose a lot of money on the options I bought today.
I think that's probably going to be the least of your worries if that's the case. But anyway, one last thing, Joe, before you leave, let everybody know where they can find you, all that good stuff on X, on YouTube, and any last words you have.
Yeah, definitely happy to welcome you guys on the channel. So it's Joe Bhakdi, J-O, and then B-H-A-K-D-I on YouTube. Then X, same thing on X. And we are also launching, or we have launched, pioneerlands.net. So Pioneer Lands, it's multiple lands. With .net, and that's a free community where we, you know, have a nice community management where we share Tesla insights. Everyone can basically, you know, grassroots bottom-up intelligence. And then we have all kinds of cool things about AGI. So we are trying to form the world's best intelligence group on intelligence, on AGI and Tesla. And politics, so we know what's going on. And it's a lot of fun because we have people from all over the world, and then we have Canadians and Swedes, and of course, a lot of Americans and Australians, and they feed us information from, what's going on in Sweden and what's in France? We just ping them. It's like, what's going on with Le Pen? And then we have French people that are like, I tell you what's going on, ping me. So it's a lot of fun. So I'm trying to build a little pioneer lens because AGI is coming, exactly what we discussed. And besides capital and being right on things and learning how to do that, network and community is the key. And maybe to finish this off, the most magic hack that I figured out over the last 2 years is the Tesla community. Because it's not just people who like Tesla and Elon Musk. It's a filter. It's a magic filter. You know, like, you know, Tesla, Boomer Mama, and Alexander, we have some back and forth, and Randy Curry. Everyone is like, not just smart, like really smart, about holistically about everything. It's like randomly a perfect filter. It's like very random because I was just an investor. I was like, and then every time I talk to Tesla, real Tesla thinkers, it's Like, why are they all smart? Like on multiple levels all the way up. Because if you are an Elon Musk fan, there's a reason for it. Like, I'm not randomly an Elon Musk fan. I'm an Elon Musk fan because what Elon does and how he thinks every time he does something, like, whoa, this was really smart. But who thinks that? People who kind of can understand it. So it's the magic filter randomly to meet great people and to be ready with them for the age of AGI. That's my thesis.
Love it. Pioneerlands.com. Make sure you check it out. Joe Bakhti on YouTube and X. .net.
I didn't have the money for
Pioneerlands.net. Okay. Fair enough. Pioneerlands.net. Joe Bakhti on X and YouTube. Make sure to check. We'll put links, all that stuff in the comment description below. Yeah, I couldn't agree more on the Tesla comment. It's like, it's so true. And I experience this every single day. And it's one of my favorite things to do is like talk to people that follow this story closely. Because again, it's like there's so many different facets and variables, and it's so counterculture in a lot of different ways that it requires a lot of very grounded thinking and non-emotional thinking to understand the story.
And complex systems thinking too. Like,
exactly.
Not just unidimensional or whatever. Like, you've got to understand layers and then complex interactions.
And yeah, now you even awesome. On top of that, you need character because crazy leftists are going to scratch your car. So it's like, it's getting even better.
A lot of variables.
Have to be courageous.
Yes. Yeah. Very, very wild times. All right, Joe. Thank you so much, man. Appreciate
thank you so much. Amazing.
Awesome. Stick around here for me real quick.